And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, we will take the occasion of NBC's live production of The Sound of Music to talk about live events. Are we really just waiting for people to fall down? Should we really be rooting for them to get up? Or is it all about the possibility of greatness? And then we will return to a segment that has been gone for far too long, the regrettable television pop quiz. You've missed it, we've missed it, and there's all kinds of television that we haven't covered. And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I cover movies and theater and that sort of thing.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, it's very good to have all of you back.
Got the whole gang.
We have the whole team back together again for the occasion of The Sound of Music. Now, I have been heard...
Is that why we came back from Thanksgiving?
Yeah. I have been heard recently about The Sound of Music itself. I both wrote a piece for the blog and then also checked in with Soundcheck on WNYC, where I faced off against a very serious and committed defender and liker of The Sound of Music. And and I will link to that so that you can listen to it for yourself, because otherwise you will not believe it. And so I do not come here to repeat my curmudgeonly complaints about The Sound of Music. Instead, we are here to talk about the fact that it is live. Now, this is something that networks used to do.
Mm-hmm.
They used to do, I believe there was a live Cinderella, perhaps. And there were a couple of live musicals that they have been saying this is kind of a throwback to.
Mm-hmm.
Trey, you seem like the guy who would know this.
Start us off, Trey.
You think that I would have an exhaustive history of live musical theater-like things on television, but I don't. It is certainly a thing that used to happen. I think Amal and the Night Visitors, the Menotti Opera, was live for television back in the 50s. But sure, and you know, you'd have live symphony concerts being carried. And, of course, way back in the day, you had live vaudevilles and skits. And
live everything.
Everything, right?
Yeah.
And there were often some sort of terrible mishaps. I mean, everything from, you know, people knocking things off a desk to the other very serious end of the spectrum, where you're seeing Jack Ruby shoot Lee Harvey Oswald on TV, right?
Uh-huh. Yes. Well, we're hoping that won't happen during The Sound of Music. And before we start this conversation, you should all be aware, we are taping this on Monday. This is going to air on Thursday. So by the time you hear it on Friday, you'll know whether anyone tripped over their feet or had any sort of singing mishap or Carrie Underwood squawked horribly or something else amazing
now,
happened.
In the pool, I have Carrie Underwood toppling into a giant tuba.
Good.
You know, Thompson, I noticed that every time you are viewing a live performance that involves instruments, your mind immediately goes to someone falling into a tuba.
I don't know why.
It's because all of the best cartoons have that moment.
I think
that's
the thing. I think I just have Warner Brothers cartoons.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sort of the equivalent of like getting your head stuck in an accordion.
Sure.
Yeah. So just so that you're aware, you know, by the time you hear this, this will all be in the past, but we are being speculative. I did notice that in one of the, I believe, New York Times stories about this production, they did talk to at least one of the cast members about the possibility of injury during a sort of a stunty scene falling into a fountain. I mean, that was really the first time I had thought about this production in those terms, that you're hoping for someone to screw up. Because, of course, I don't think of these people as people who would screw up. Most of them are Broadway actors, aside from Carrie Underwood. And Carrie Underwood has done a season of American Idol singing.
I was going to say, she's worked without a net as much as anybody.
Yeah,
right.
In front of many, many millions.
What it's trying to capture is, I believe, Trey Graham would call it the frisson of live theater.
I'm not that bad.
Good, okay. So it's trying to capture this feeling of we're all in this together, this sense of community that you feel in a theater. I would argue that sort of feeling really kind of fades, because you almost forget that you're in a theater with other people, and you were just, when something crazy happens on stage, then all of a sudden you feel it again. Or when, to a lesser extent, I think, when some massively choreographed piece goes off without a hitch, you start to, you know, look around at other people. That's certainly what television was founded upon, and radio was founded upon, because everything was live.
Yeah.
But then as soon as videotape and audio tape came along, more and more people got away from that, and in response, the stuff that was put out over the airwaves turned a little bit more safer, had that hermetic quality. And if you doubt that, just remember that they were so desperate for that feeling of a sense of community that they introduced a thing called the laugh track, which is nothing but trying to dupe us all into thinking that there are other people around us in our living rooms watching, you know, Hazel or Dennis the Menace, which stuff that doesn't lend itself to have a communal experience like that.
There is something very special about being in the room breathing the same air with people who are doing a live performance. You lose some of that when you do it live but on broadcast. Mm-hmm. But what you get in exchange is the sense that the stakes are a lot higher because millions and millions of people might be watching it with you.
Yeah.
And it's been a little while since this kind of thing happened. I mean, there was the live 30 Rock, right?
Mm-hmm.
The experience of watching this with Twitter will be very interesting.
Yeah, that's true.
Twitter will just be poised waiting for people to fail the entire time.
That's it. That's the way we get back to that feeling of all being in this together. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a very circuitous way to get back to that feeling of watching it live. It's the closest we can get to being in a theater with other people if you're tweeting with people.
Instead of the collective intake of breath, you get the collective hashtag.
Yeah, but it is interesting the extent to which I think everybody assumes, oh, well, we're going to wait for something to go horribly, horribly awry, when most of the actors in this production of Sound of Music, I mean, it's like Audra McDonald.
Yeah,
it's people who go out on stage without a net all the time.
Right.
And it doesn't mean that no one on stage ever flubs lines. But the idea that, oh, it's going to go disastrously off the rails. I mean, every halftime show at every sporting event is happening live in front of a zillion people.
Right.
And the Super Bowl halftime
award
show.
Awards shows.
I mean, you think about that production number in the Tonys where mm-hmm. where Neil Patrick Harris is actually doing jumps, literally jumping through a hoop. Nobody necessarily was like sitting there waiting for him to screw up. They just assumed he would pull it off. And I would assume that in this particular production of The Sound of Music, that they'll pull it off just fine.
Sure. I would imagine.
And
so,
I will be incredibly disappointed.
I mean, we almost SNL is such an institution that we almost forget that it's live every week because it's on greased rails. That thing is a machine. That thing has a way to work. And somebody flubs a line, somebody breaks, somebody can't read a cue card. I've argued before that the L in SNL is almost the least important thing about it. I think back in the day when it first started and it had this really transgressive anti-establishment feel to it, the sensibility, that's when the live aspect of it was really cutting edge, and now it's just a thing that SNL does. It doesn't have that same sort of sense of immediacy that I think it's going for.
Well, and I think that the stakes may be a little lower. I mean, when you think about the career of Charles Rocket, who famously dropped an F-bomb on Saturday Night Live, that was a career killer. I mean, that was a gigantic disaster. But, you know, if there was an F-bomb dropped on Saturday Night Live, which it still does occasionally happen, it would be a story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was 2004 when, like, part of Janet Jackson's breast gave us all the vapors, you know. So let's, you know, not pretend that everything has completely changed.
Right.
But I do think that a screw-up would be sort of a momentary... And then everyone
I think that's what happened to Jenny Slate a couple of years ago. And she did indeed lose her gig fairly quickly on Saturday Night Live. And she's popped up in enough other things that I think a lot of people feel like perhaps they could have treated her a little better. But I don't know that the assumption is that it's because of that, even though it was a story.
Yeah.
It was a thing people talked about,
you make a good point with the whole low stakes thing, because when a conventional sitcom or television show does a live episode, it feels like a gimmick. It doesn't really feel like this transgressive, amazing thing. When, like, the live ER, the live 30 Rocks, I mean, they were fun, but the live Rock starring Charles Dutton.
I was going to bring up Rock, because there was not only a live Rock, there was a live season of Rock.
Yeah,
the entire second season of Rock, this is about 20 years ago, was done live. You had all these theater actors, they decided the show just had a different energy when they did it live. But I think that different energy is a big part of what makes shows like the Live ER and the Live 30 Rock a little, they don't feel quite right, because they're just changing the sound of the air in the room.
That's true.
Yeah.
There was a live Will and Grace for no reason whatsoever. There was a live West Wing.
Yep.
But Gimme a Break, the Nell Carter show, was one of the very first to do this whole idea of a live episode.
One of the first after the rise of the taped. I mean, because until about 1958, most broadcast television was done live. I mean, you had occasional stuff that was shot on film, you know, before that.
Yeah.
But the holy crap moment, whether it's a holy crap that went really well or holy crap somebody's fallen and can't get up. I remember the live Failsafe, George Clooney produced and directed, I think, a black and white remake of the
nuclear horror movie.
Right. And, you know, somebody missed a line, a camera didn't go where it was supposed to do, but that's it. That's all you got from that. That's the energy it had.
Well, and on the one hand, we talk about their award shows all the time. It's not that big of a deal. They do this on awards, they do this in halftime shows. But it is true that you can go back and say, yeah, they do it all the time in halftime shows, but they had a power failure at a, not during the halftime show, but, you know, you never know what could happen.
Right.
And you have occasional things like Bret Michaels getting hit on the head
by
the
screen. I was
going to
say.
Right.
You really do never know what might happen. And every now and then something does happen that qualifies as a screw up.
And quite frankly, I'm going to be sitting there poised with my finger on the trigger when they get to the Lonely Goatard.
Yeah, well,
someday, my children, I will impart to you the story of the Sound of Music tour of Salzburg, Austria that I took many years ago.
We have buried the lead.
That was a poop show, and it was not. It is not suitable for air because it made me angry. But yeah, that's a thing.
I like the fact that you left it to our imagination. That's so much worse.
I will say, after I ran the Curmudgeon's Guide to the Sound of Music, there was a guy who sent me a photo of himself saying that he toured a bunch of these places in Salzburg. Mm-hmm. And he sent me this incredibly awesome side-by-side shot of Julie Andrews during Do Re Mi when she's standing on the steps with her hand on her head and her other hand over her head, and himself doing the same thing in the same spot. And it is so delightful. I think he tweeted it at me, so I think I can pass it on to the rest of you. And I will, because it was amazing. It made me smile very, very, very broadly. So,
I've got a question for Trey Graham.
Mm.
Now, when you have this combination of theater actors and TV actors or film actors, among stage actors, is there like a gigantic resentment toward fancy pants film actors coming in thinking they can do it?
That's a good question. I would imagine that there is some of that feeling. I have certainly...
You're just assuming that there's resentment among stage actors.
Among actors.
I imagine there's not.
Yeah, I heard a lot of conversation when Smash was on the air about how...
Another American Idol
right,
alum, yeah.
How crappy that was and how she had to take that down a key. I can do that in my sleep.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, you have to assume that people like Audra McDonald and the other theater actors who are involved in this could name you a bunch of eminently qualified theater actresses who would have killed for this opportunity, blah, blah, blah. Not that they would necessarily, but that they could if you asked them.
Sure, yeah. But, you know, at the same time, Audra has worked back and forth across that line.
Absolutely,
so
she has.
She's, you know, she knows what she's doing on stage.
Absolutely.
And she, from what I know of her, she is just really gracious and professional and collegial.
And I have to say, she approvingly retweeted, and it made my day, the Curmudgeon's Guide to the Sound of
Music.
Did she
really?
Amazing.
Did. It was very awesome. Okay. It was great fun. It was great fun, except for the guy who was super mad at me on soundcheck. Gotta check it out. But it was funny because I was going to bring this briefly back around to, of course, the world of politics. Because I wrote a thing on the blog when Marco Rubio, during the Republican response to the State of the Union or whatever
it was
talking and had to pause in the middle to grab the bottle of water in this incredibly awkward gesture.
He had to reach about 9 feet.
Not his fault. And I was talking in the piece about why did this become such a sort of memed moment. It's not because it's that big of a deal to have a dry mouth. It's because it's the one moment in the whole evening that isn't meticulously planned out.
Right.
So there's a part of that desire to see something go quote-unquote wrong that's not malicious. It's just that you like it when people's humanity is exposed a little bit.
Well, and in political debates, it often is malicious. Like Rick
right.
Perry.
Of course.
When Rick Perry couldn't name
when
one of the departments that he would eliminate and just stops and just says, oops.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it does have that feeling of, like, wanting the person to have a bad experience because you don't like what they're saying, which for some people that was.
Right, there was a lot of schadenfreude for people who didn't like Rick Perry.
Of course,
but
what I'm saying is that whether you liked Rubio or didn't, there's part of that water bottle moment that's just you recognizing how you would feel in that moment, like that you're talking, your mouth is getting dry, and all you're realizing, water's all the way over there, what am I going to do? And so I'm just saying, like, I hope a little bit that something unplanned happens, but it's not because I want bad things to happen to
sure.
people. It's not really schadenfreude. It's just that you like it when those unplanned things that kind of make life bumpy and interesting happen.
Well, and a great recovery the one that jumps immediately to my mind, a sideline reporter for ESPN named Susie Colbert.
Oh, she's the best.
Who is, let's stop and say Susie Colbert is so awesome.
She is so awesome. And she's not only awesome because of this, but
yes,
tell this story.
But the story, oh my God. I feel like it was a preseason game. It involved the New York Jets. And Susie Colbert is doing a sideline interview. And she has been tasked with interviewing Joe Namath, who is, to put it delicately, pickled.
Yeah.
Probably.
And has since spoken of his troubles with being pickled.
And immediately, you know, went into treatment. And so she's talking about, I don't know, the quarterback situation at the Jets. How do you feel about, you know, Mark Sanchez or Chad Pennington, whoever it was? And he's kind of teetering and he looks at her, you know, kind of glassy eyed, and she's, I want to kiss you.
And
it happens again.
Yeah, she says it again.
She tries to power through it, and he says it again, and she just kind of turns to the camera and goes, thanks, Joe, a great compliment, and just calls it back to the broadcast booth. And mm-hmm. It was like you didn't even see a glimmer of panic on that woman's face. She is so unflappable and handled it so coolly. I think that's one thing that you look for in these situations.
Absolutely.
You're not looking for people crashing and burning. You're looking for
the stunning recovery.
Right.
One of my favorite stories in that regard, it's such a natural segue from ESPN. It was either at the Metropolitan Opera or at Bayreuth. at the Bayreuth Festival. I believe it's Thomas Beecham, and they're doing Götterdämmerung or something, and somebody rides the horse on, and the horse turns its back to the audience.
I have no idea where this is going.
The horse turns its back to the audience and drops a gigantic poop. And Thomas Beecham, from the podium, just turns to the audience and says, everyone's a critic.
Right. So I think we all hope that should something go wrong, someone has some fantastic recovery, and there are certainly plenty of people involved in this production who could easily have one.
Can I
drop a giant poop.
I was going to say, can I root for The Sound of Music to go off wonderfully well and for a horse to take a dump?
You can. So you should come and find all of us on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. And I did want to mention while we're talking about live events that this is the last podcast that you will hear before we record on December 10th, our live show here at NPR HQ. And the reason, one of the reasons I wanted to mention this was we do intend to have a Q&A during this show. So obviously, if you're coming to the live show, be ready.
Bring a horse.
Yeah, this would be a really bad time for us to be talking about Schadenfreude or wanting live events to go wrong. But if you're coming to the show, definitely bring your question. And if you're not coming to the show, feel free to drop us a question on Facebook or something like that. So that brings us to the middle section of our show, which is returning us to a segment that, frankly, I think we have not done in far too long.
Mm-hmm.
Are you ready, Stephen?
I'm as ready as I'll ever be.
All right, here we go. Regrettable Television Pop Quiz. So what we do in Regrettable Television Pop Quiz is that we listen to a clip from some show, usually regrettable, although occasionally just silly and not entirely regrettable. And we see if we can figure out what it is. Now, most of these I submitted, and so you will all be doing the guessing. Lauren, start us off.
We have houses all over the world, and every house has its servants in it, and making the bed isn't something I usually tend to do. I just wake up, and when I come back, it's made. One of my passions is animals. I've always been a huge animal lover. Right now, I have literally have a son, which is my dog, Sniffy. His name is Snifferson, actually, but Sniffy for short.
He literally has a son who is a dog. You know, I feel like they're burying the lead on what the show is about.
Snifferson.
Is that some sort of like $1 million listing type show?
Mm-hmm. Or is it Ryan Lochte's show?
It is not Ryan Lochte's show, although that would be
awesome.
That's
a good guess.
He's not nearly that articulate, I have to tell you. He is not nearly.
Wow, I have no guess.
All right, I'm going to give you this title in the form of song. Secret Princes Will Adore You. The show is called Secret Princes, and it's on TLC. Okay. And I realized after I gave her the clip that our producer, Lauren McGaughey, actually knows this show. So what happens on Secret Princes is that these dudes come out, and they, of course, date a bunch of women. And I assume that the fact that they're princes is a secret, because that's what makes them Secret Princes.
Yeah.
And then there's a lot of dating. I think it's kind of like Reverse Joe Millionaire.
I was going to say, there's
like
kind kind of a Joe Millionaire, but there's also a secret millionaire show. All those awful rich people are
well,
our saviors.
If you have been dying to meet a guy who will tell you that his dog is literally his son and his name is Snifferson, Secret Princess is for you. So that is a point for no one. A point for no one. Yeah. All right, hit me, Lauren.
I intend to hurt Alan tonight, but not go like full out on him. I want to push him, but push him so that he can learn.
I've never been raised to hit any kind of woman.
Right now, I'm here to watch Alan get his ass kicked. I just came to solely watch Alan get his face beaten in by a girl.
Is this the one you wrote about not long ago?
Is this white collar?
That's my guess.
Brawlers.
Color brawlers.
It is white collar brawlers. That is a three quarters of a point for Glenn and a quarter of a point for Trey.
Is that on the Esquire?
Yes.
what you described as a network for fellas?
Yeah. That is the network for fellas, Esquire TV. That is white collar brawlers, where what they do is two dudes who don't get along at work come in and are briefly trained in boxing and then fight each other. It's the only proof you will ever need that if Fight Club really existed, it would be the saddest thing ever saw.
A lot of slap fights.
It would be the saddest thing you ever saw in your life. And of course, what's happening in this clip is that the guy is being trained by a female boxer who's an actual boxer. Because he's going through his training. And his trainer is like, well, I have someone who could probably kick your ass. It's a woman. So she comes in and she's like, well, I'm going to go easy on him. I believe it's the opponent who has come to see him get his ass kicked by a girl during training.
Wow. See, I will say there are a lot of reality TV shows in which all I want is for people to get punched in the face.
That's exactly what I said when I wrote about this show. It's like, that's what makes it great. This is a show full of punchable people who are going to get punched. You should be watching.
Great satisfaction.
Is there a show in which reality television contestants are like hurled into a volcano?
All right. Hit me, Lauren.
What is sitting here at room temperature?
Chicken.
Raw chicken.
I'll bet it's not in the danger zone yet.
What temperature is that?
57.2.
57 degrees. Chicken should never be over 40 degrees.
I don't know the name of the show, but it's the Big Bruiser guy. Who's the restaurant guy, right? Big bald bruiser guy?
No, it's not that guy. You're thinking of Robert Irvine, who does Restaurant Impossible.
Oh, right, and he's British. Never mind.
Yeah.
And there's no accent, so it's not Gordon Ramsay.
No, it's definitely not Gordon Ramsay.
It's not Gordon Ramsay.
Though he has been known to scream about
chicken. It's the other one. It's the guy who does a show called Bar Rescue.
Oh, sure.
And he goes around and he rescues bars.
Well, and occasionally, my favorite bar rescue story is pirates.
Yes.
Which is in the town where I live.
Yes.
And where they decided in this fairly working class neighborhood that what they really wanted instead of a pirate themed bar what did they call it? The corporate bar and grill?
They called it corporate, I think.
So what they did was it's like what people in this neighborhood really want is to pay $15 for a cheeseburger.
Yeah. Well,
so they took one kind of misbegotten idea that had like super devoted clientele and replaced it with something nobody wanted.
And you can't call it corporate. Like that.
Well, seriously, it's like, why not just call it D-Bags? With
off,
a Z.
They were better off with the pirates. I was going to say, have you ever been to pirates?
Yes.
You have? We're talking about this later. I can't believe you've been to pirates. All right, next one, Lauren.
Today we're meeting up with Granddaddy to look at some guns. Hopefully, Granddaddy can push for a chance to propose to me. If not, well, there are a lot of guns here.
Oh my gosh, look at all of these guns. Oh my God, there's a hot pink one. Bye.
Got nothing. Got absolutely nothing.
I just realized I don't remember what I remember pulling the clip. Yes. It is called Big Tips Texas. And it is on, I think, like maybe MTV or something like that. And it's the girls who work at this like kind of Coyote Ugly but much kind of
without all the class and distinction.
Yes.
So Hooters-esque.
And it's a sort of a Hooters-esque Texas bar. The name of the show is Big Tips. Get it?
I see what they did there.
See what they did there. All right. Next clip.
So you would consider me your friend?
Yeah.
So when MJ says everyone at this table is my friend and not yours, we don't even want you here, why would you not say something?
I've known her for years.
Okay, so you're her friend.
The reason I chose this clip is that this is everything Stephen loves about reality television.
I was going to say.
It's women sitting around arguing resentfully over who is whose friend. Right.
I was going to say, is it called junior high drama?
Uh-huh. Well, that was, you know, my synopsis of all of Real Housewives was, I can't believe she didn't qual.
Exactly.
It was like the entire series in
a nutshell. Okay, so the hint I would give you about this show is that this is one of several shows that came up after Jersey Shore, in the theory that for every ethnic group, there is a reality show full of gossiping
jackasses
just waiting to be made.
Wow.
The Shahs of Beverly Hills?
Sunset.
The
Shahs
Sunset.
Of Sunset.
Wow.
So you were very close here. I'm giving you the point. The Shahs of Sunset. And they say Persians. Mm-hmm. This is the Persian population put in the same position as the Italian population for the purposes of Jersey Shore.
Yeah. Oh.
Because, you know, as I said.
Congrats, Persians.
For every ethnic distinction, there is someone out there who would like to make a reality show suggesting that all you do is fight with each other. All right, next clip.
She has to save the store.
This Christmas could be our last.
I'm training Mr. Bauer's son.
He just might win her heart.
I'm not such a bad guy.
If you're not going to fall right in love with him, can I?
That's a trailer, of course.
Yeah.
And for those of you who are here for the holiday television quiz, you might have heard of this.
Okay. Because the holiday thing was signified by the tinkling.
The tinkling bells.
Yes.
And she spoke at the beginning about saving the store.
I took the quiz. I don't remember.
Tick-tock. This is a movie called Hats Off to Christmas.
Wow, damn it.
Which does not take place in Hats, Nebraska.
No, that's what I remember of that particular.
Which is one of the choices I actually sort of watched.
Does she work in a Santa hat factory?
She works in a store.
But the developer wants to close the orphanage.
Like, they got to save the community center.
So they recruit a bunch of reindeer or something.
To play a basketball game that they have to win.
It's just the fact to me that there's an actual Hallmark movie that's actually called Hats Off to Christmas is like, that's amazing. I mean, come on.
Isn't it amazing?
It's
amazing the word you wanted to go there.
Yes, it is amazing. All right, next clip.
Seriously, I was making sure that Ariana and Tom aren't f***ing, so stop.
I know they're not f***ing.
Okay, well, I was asking Sheena, and I wanted to be...
Why would you even ask that?
Because I'm concerned, because everyone is saying it, and so I'm really over you,
coming
at me
right
saying,
now?
Like, you were
are
doing something...
Are you that dumb to believe
I don't know. I wanted to know. I'm sorry.
I'm not worried about it. Why the f*** would you be worried about it?
Because I'm concerned for you.
I admire that clip for the profanity density.
Right?
In it.
I'm just making sure.
Why would you ask Sheena?
You know, I just the notion of, like, setting your DVR or, like, making an appointment to hang out with those people.
Yes. This is a spinoff of a Real Housewives franchise.
Woof.
I will say that. This is one of the many spinoffs. This is the show Vanderpump Rules.
Miss Vanderpump.
You all may remember Miss Barry Hardiman sitting in this very room talking about Lips Vanderpump.
Lips Vanderpump.
Now her name is not Lips, but her name is Vanderpump.
Uh-huh.
And this is her spinoff show, Vanderpump Rules. So that's that. All right, next one.
What happens when complete strangers compete?
It's good. This sucks.
At the dinner table. Who will toast?
Hello, darling.
And roast.
She's a lunatic mental patient.
The best dinner party.
I'm gonna win this.
What's the lowest score you have?
Connoisseurs of British television might be able to come up with this, as it is an adaptation of an extraordinarily popular British television show.
Wow, I don't know.
Very popular television
show. Is that Night on Bald Mountain they're playing?
This is the adaptation of a show called Come Dine With Me. In the British version, which I have seen, you have like four people, and each person hosts a dinner party at their house, and the other three like go to their house, right? And so you have four people who each make dinner for each other, and they all score each other. And the idea is you can't just score everybody else brutally, because they would just do the same thing to you. So you get scored on like who threw the nicest dinner party. And the thing is, in the British version, there's a lot of like, there's a little bit of sniping in the background, but there's also a lot of like, I really enjoyed the roast, that kind of thing. In this
capital
version,
trifle.
Capital trifle. In this version, it seems to just all be people who hate each other's food.
And okay, and they're not celebrities. They're just randos mm-hmm. that they slam together.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Come dine with me. All right, next clip.
I conserve tissues. I feel like a lot of times people blow their nose, and there's still sections of the tissues they can still use. I kind of keep a little burrow, a little collection in the corner here of my bed. Like, you see, this could still be used. This is all good right here. So let's say I use that, and it's like now the tissue is garbage.
Is there such a thing as extreme hoarders?
I was going to say, is it one of these, like, you won't believe that this guy eats the hair in the shower
My
drain.
Strange obsession.
My strange obsession. That's
it's not that. He's more into the fact that he doesn't want to waste the
money.
The tissues. Because he is.
Is he an extreme couponer?
Extreme millionaire? Extreme cheapskate?
Extreme cheapskates. That's exactly what it is. It's extreme cheapskates TLC.
Wow.
He just doesn't think that you should throw away an entire tissue just because you blew your nose on parts of it. What he shows on the clip is that he keeps a little pile of used Kleenex because they still have good parts in them that you can still use to blow
your nose. He doesn't rip off the piece.
No.
He just keeps the
Waits for it to dry.
Oh.
He just keeps the whole thing. Yeah. So that brings us to the end of our regrettable television pop quiz. I can't say you got very many of them right, but I think we all feel a little smarter.
Yeah, I definitely
I'm not regretting my decision not to study up.
I think we all feel a little bit smarter. And that brings us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, over the Thanksgiving weekend, I replaced my car. I no longer drive a 2005 Chrysler Town & Country with 170,000 miles on it. I drive a 2005 different kind of car with 106,000 miles on it. For me, a car is essentially casing for its stereo. And this particular car, nothing else matters. If it was like the Flintstones car and I had to use my feet to propel it forward, but it had the USB port that it has so that I can listen to my iPod in the car, I would probably make that trade. And so I drove to and from Wisconsin, from Washington, D.C. for Thanksgiving to see my mom and sister, and had a delightful time and everything. I had the kids with me. And on the way back, we made many stops for whatever reason at Taco Bell. And so I started...
whatever reason.
because Taco Bell's delicious.
To read the paper.
to hug the building.
To hug the building warmly. And so I started singing to the kids the song Danger High Voltage by Electric Six, which has the line, fire in the disco, fire in the Taco Bell. And so I started singing that in the car, as one does. And so whim-based music listening has not been a thing for me in the car, basically ever.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I was like, I can play the kids Electric Six. Mm-hmm. And so I started, so I played them the song Improper Dancing, which is one of my favorite songs ever. Everybody's doing it in the middle of the street. Everybody's moving. Well, they shouldn't be moving. Everybody's moving it in the middle of the street. Improper dancing. In the middle of the street. Improper dancing. In the middle of the street. Improper dancing. In the middle of the street. Somebody
chair dancing.
One of the reasons was so excited to play it for the kids is it has this moment late in the song where he goes, stop! Continue! It's just, oh my God! Electric Six, the album Fire, is a record I love. And that took me to, this is literally 14, 15 hours into an 18-hour car trip. I played the entire album I Get Wet by Andrew W.K. And what I found is I had the exact same experience listening to this record that I had at South by Southwest this year. Where at South by Southwest on about night four at about 11 o'clock at night, I saw Andrew W.K. live. And it was like when you're playing a video game and the power bar, like how much energy you have left before you just keel over. My little power bar was down to almost nothing. And then I saw Andrew W.K. live and it just went 100%. And I had the exact same experience in the car after this obscene amount of driving. I'd been driving all night and it was like 9 o'clock in the morning. And listening to Andrew W.K.'s I Get Wet completely restored me. Lauren, please hit me with a little bit of It's Time to Party.
It's time to party. Let's party. Tell you what you
I Get Wet is from 2001. It is start to finish literally one of my favorite albums of all time. It is just every second of that album is engineered to meet the next second on that album, and it is just this masterfully crafted just anthem, bigger anthem, bigger anthem, bigger anthem. And it is
Sunday, Sunday.
It is. It's oh my God, it is just so fantastic. And I asked my son, who was sitting next to me, I said, okay, on a scale of 10 to 10, 10 being the greatest thing you've ever heard, and 10 being the greatest thing you've ever heard, how would you rate this record? And he gave it a 10.
Well, good for him.
I just, I don't want anyone to miss the fact that was Trey Graham saying Sunday. I just feel we all need to stop and take notice. Thank you, Stephen Thompson.
It
Trey Graham.
It restored your mana, as we gamers would say.
It did.
Blue thing coming up. Yeah, nice.
Trey Graham, what is making you happy this week?
Well, there is one little musical thing making me happy this week. It is Monday. You may have seen going around the internet today that that Tasty and Crazy Eyes have made a Christmas music video.
Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way.
That was Tasty and Crazy Eyes, the actresses who play Tasty and Crazy Eyes, who are, of course, from Orange is the New Black, just as charming as can be. The other thing that's making me happy is a long piece in New York Magazine called The Sondheim Puzzle, I believe is the title of it. It's a long personal essay by Frank Rich about his long friendship and long experience covering Stephen Sondheim, the musical theater composer, who is the topic of a thing that is very much going to be making me happy very, very soon. Bob Mandela discussed it in his year-end sort of holiday movie preview. It's called Six by Sondheim, and it's an HBO special that Frank Rich and James Lapine have been working on. And I have been lucky enough to preview parts of it, and it is beautiful.
And there are a bunch of clips of, I think, classic sort of performances, but then there are also a few things they restaged specifically for this.
They did. For instance, in the section where they're talking about Send in the Clowns, they've staged a beautiful film with Audra McDonald in an evening gown in a dimly lit space.
I'm in.
With her gorgeous musical theater star husband, Will Swenson, playing the guitar while she sings Send in the Clowns.
I'm wildly in. I'm all kinds of in. I haven't seen any of this yet, but it's on my radar, too.
Yep.
Thank you, Trey Graham.
You're welcome.
Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Well, speaking of best ofs, because Bob Mandela named that in his best of list, we all agree best of lists suck. They're terrible. Mm-hmm. Making them, and I know that sounds terrible to kind of whinge about how bad it is for us to
I'm sorry. Making best of lists is just the most wonderful task in the world compared to compiling a gift guide. I will do best ofs all day if I don't have to do it.
Well,
a
this
guide.
Is going to be a bit of log rolling then, because what the NPR Books folks have done is a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B in creating the NPR Book Concierge, which will be live on the site by the time you hear this. This is the best books of 2013 in a way, but what it really is a guide to help you select your own according to your taste, what books that are highly recommended by NPR should be on your shelf or that you should give to a loved one. Because what I love about this is that you go to the site npr.org/bestbooks, and what you see is just lots and lots of book covers. But then you go over to the side and you start filtering out tags like page turners or seriously great writing or tomes or one day reads. And as you filter through, you will see this magical egalitarian thing happening where romance is next to science fiction, next to YA, next to literary fiction, next to poetry, because what determines what's being sort of offered to you is your choice. You can filter by age, you can filter by YA if you want, or you can just filter by goodness, because all these books are great. I contributed to it in a small way.
So did I.
As did you, I know. It's just, it looks great. It functions wonderfully. That's npr.org/bestbooks for the NPR Book Concierge.
Wonderful. I would also just give a little shout to the fact that that's also a product of our tremendous books team.
Yes.
Here at NPR, in addition to our wonderful news apps team.
Sure.
But also our books team with our friend Ellen Silva, our friend Rose Friedman, our friends Beth Novi and Nicole Cohen and Petra Mayer. And so everybody's worked really hard on it, and I'm very glad Glenn brought it up. I will say, as my first sub thing making me happy this week, that what I contributed to this was a few words about Eleanor and Park, a YA book by Rainbow Rowell that I've spoken about a bunch of times and also written about on the blog, which I recently found out is staying on the shelves at the library in Anoka County, Minnesota, after a challenge. And I was very, very happy to hear that because I think it's a lovely book. And the more people read it, the better. So two things making me happy this week. First, last week, after I explained what made me happy, I realized that I had screwed it up. And so we had to cut it because I was on vacation and unable to retrack it. So we cut the whole thing. So people kept saying, Linda, what was making you happy last week? I would never deprive you of what was making me happy last week, especially since it was so awesome. What I had done last week and what I will do now is read from the greatest PR flack email of all time, which came from a publicist for a company called Barley and Britches, which is promoting a new pant that they have invented.
A new pant.
A premium pant that fits your lifestyle and wallet.
And I'm sorry, how brilliant is this publicist? Like, what is the likelihood that you would otherwise pay attention to an email about
I pants? Would not at all.
No.
But here is the relevant part of the email that I wanted to share with everyone. Do women actually judge you on a first date based on the pants that you wear to the bar or the restaurant? To answer this question, we conducted a survey representative of 1,300 respondents. Some interesting findings on men and their first date pants include, if you want women to think you're rich, responsible, and a perfect long-term partner, wear khaki-colored pants. If you want to seem like a wild, adventurous, offbeat, or creative date, wear colorful pants like dark red or bright blue, but you also run the risk of being seen like just a hookup. If you want ladies to think you like the finer things in life, wear dark but still colorful pants such as dark purple. Wearing green pants will communicate that you're a world traveler, but that you also may live with your parents. And then it goes on to explain, of course, why you should buy these pants and that they're doing their pants on Kickstarter. As I said, the publicist for Barley and Britches, as much as I don't normally like to do what Judge Judd Hodgman refers to as buzz marketing, I felt that I had to read that email because I just felt it was mandatory.
That was, in fact, crazy pants.
Yeah. I find every time I pull a pair of pants out of my closet, my immediate question is, what will the ladies think?
The other thing making me happy this week, I was on vacation over Thanksgiving and very much determined to only pay attention to things that I would not make any use of in my job at all. And thus, I am failing right now because one of the things I discovered because I asked on Twitter what I should watch and pay attention to while I was on vacation was an Australian television series that came to me recommended by, one, Margaret H. Wilson, who said, I think you should watch Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries. Now, this is on Netflix. This is an Australian series starring a woman named Essie Davis, and more importantly, a man named Nathan Page, who is a former cyclist. There's nothing not to like about that. And Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries is a series about a detective whose name is Phryne Fisher. Her name is P-H-R-Y-N-E, Phryne. Not a name many of us are accustomed to, but apparently it was fine in Melbourne in the sort of mid to late 1920s when this story takes place. So Phryne has this incredibly fashionable bob and runs around in a big boa, and she goes around to different parties and meets different people and solves mysteries. And she's a lady detective. It's so well written. It's so charming. And let me just tell you, Nathan Page as Detective Inspector Jack Robinson, oh my God! The fact that America has not yet imported this particular fellow is a harsh judgment upon us all. And you will all agree with me as soon as you watch Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries, which is streaming on Netflix, the first 13 episodes. It's just lovely, and I adored it. So Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries on Netflix is the other thing making me happy this week.
I have one small addition, which I can't believe I didn't think of before, but hi, Tom Daly. And then I have a small correction, because whenever I was talking about the musicals that I saw in New York, I apparently mispronounced the name of the lady who wrote the graphic novel. And I got a Twitter correction from one of our faithful who said, from my mouth to hopefully yours, here is the lady herself telling the New York Times how to pronounce her name. How do you pronounce your name, Allison? It's Bechtel, rhymes with rectal. So I submit that for the record.
Nice.
Not Bechdel test. Bechdel test.
Thank you, Trey Graham. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, S-D-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow him under that name if you're a lady who likes irony. You can follow Trey Graham at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham, just like the lovely cracker crust on a pie that a lady would adore. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. He writes about Superman. You can follow our producer Lauren Magaki at L Magaki, M-I-G-A-K-I. She's pushing all the buttons this week. You can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's wonderful band, Hello, Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are stylishly bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we'll see you back here next week.